Let's continue. We have some fascinating things to explore as far as this Mishnah, and what will eventually become clear, and hopefully we'll see, it's going to take us a little bit of time for this really to emerge clearly, is that the Mishnah is inseparable from the Sugya. And which I mean, in which sense I mean, not that it's necessarily talking about the Sugya, but that trying to understand the Mishnah is inseparable from understanding the Sugya. So they may end up indeed being separated, but the effort to understand the message of the Mishnah is going to come up again and again as we try to understand the details of the Sugya. So that's why we're going to spend so much time on it, and we're not even going to finish it in one shot, because as we go back and forth in seeing the pratim that emerge from the sugyas, it's going to reflect back on trying to appreciate what the Mishnah is or isn't saying. So just to give us a little context as to why you've been given so many perushim on this Mishnah to look at, and it's not necessarily the end. You'll see that there may be more yet to comment on this Mishnah, and figuring out what it says to us and the message overall is going to be important to appreciate the dinim that emerged from the Gemaras. And as we mentioned yesterday, we're not sure what the Gemaras are trying to tell us. Is the Gemara, when it's that whole phrase, kofen al midas tom, we said yesterday, might be a little bit of an internal contradiction, as Shmuel would say, a tarat v'sasri, perhaps, because when we were talking about staka, so we took it as a given that there is a tension between, or maybe even a incompatibility between the idea of kfiya and midos, that you can be kofa somebody's behavior, but you presumably cannot be kofa their midos. So what do we mean when we say kofin al midas don? Does that mean that we actually are trying to compel certain kinds of behavior, certain kinds of traits? And maybe it's a theme of this week's parsha, as we mentioned. Or really, does it not mean that at all? But just midas tom is an idea that we derive from this Mishnah, which then goes on to tell us how we regulate principles of behavior. And then, based on that, that then impacts other codes. So then we get into kfiya because of that, but really we're not trying to be kofa as anybody, we're not trying to be kofa anybody's midos. And this really goes back a little bit to the first Mishnah and the whole question of how do we decide, right? Just to reflect for a second here in a very proper kind of end of the year mode. So to reflect on our introductory shiur of Bava Basra and the whole question of what's going on with Hashutfin. So if we were to understand there, for example, just remember and to reminisce about that discussion, so if we were to say that we're dealing with dinim in this mesechta and in this parak that are not necessarily explicit in the Torah, or not necessarily even derivable directly from the Torah, and maybe were enacted by Chazal b'chach masam, but in realization of principles from the Torah, maybe in a way that is even different than Bava Kamma and Bava Metzia. So maybe this is yet another example of that, that just like Chazal had to figure out Hilchos Shchenim based on certain principles and then figured out rules. So the Mishnah is telling us, Mishnah Avos is telling us that there's a notion of Midas Tom, and Midas Tom tells us something, and therefore the halacha in regulating how people interact in the public square is going to be based on that, because the halacha is going to put into practice values. And the values are telling us something. Okay, so far so good. Now also a question that I think is important just to keep in mind in the background here, especially when thinking about the Mishnah and thinking about stone. This is something which I think really we do need to reflect upon. Is, you know, we think of stone as the worst of the worst. Right, that's the whole way it's presented in the Torah. They are so terrible, they are not compatible with continued existence. They have to be wiped out. And even Avram Avinu's pleading for them cannot redeem them. So the assumption is there's something just utterly horrific. And in a sense, it's a little bit comparable then, just on that level, to Amalek, right? We're told, wipe out Amalek, there's no redeeming them, and they have to be eliminated completely. And in a sense, you might even say it's a little worse than Amalek, because Amalek, we spoke about, if you take the Rambam's position, that you can be Mekabel Gerim from Amalek, so then Amalek, the ideology, for sure has to be wiped out, but the individuals, theoretically, might be redeemable. They could leave the ideology. But here, the whole point is stone the individuals, we're hopeless. We're incorrigible. So you don't even normally see it phrased this way, but you could maybe make the case don't be worse than Amalek. So how does this translate to say this is, we have to then understand, call Midas Stom, it has to really somehow connect to the worst possible characters on earth. Their own?
Yeah, well, Zach and I were discussing during Seder, then why, I guess, in the Mishnah, does the Midas Stom part come up in the context of Bainanus and not by Arusha, if it seems like Midas Stom is more paradigmatic of the Russia?
All right, that's a great question. Right? It's a great question. So first of all, then, is Russia even the worst thing you can be?
Right?
And really, no pun intended, because it's a serious matter, but I was actually thinking that's actually the question today, is Russia the worst thing you can be? Are you SSIA? Because it's a big topic of discussion today, and it's the current climate. We know that there are horrific atrocities being perpetrated by Russia as we speak. Right? And this past week, we had Yom HaShoah. So how does it compare? You know, there are people who draw the comparisons, and the question is, Russia committing a genocide or not? It's actually very relevant to understanding this Mishnah, because just to kind of lay out, so I think we can see gradations of evil, and should they be all put in one bowl, and are they being put in one bowl here? So a tzaddik is one who is righteous and is caring, I'm speaking very generally, is caring about others. So theoretically, you could have somebody who doesn't care at all about helping anybody else, but is not harming anyone else either. Right? So where does he fit in on the spectrum? So he's not doing anything bad to anyone, but he's not lifting a finger to help anyone else. Right? So theoretically, we might be talking about him somewhere in our Mishnah. But clearly, you could get much worse. Right? So what about a person who doesn't want to give up anything? On one level, a person doesn't want to give up anything to help anyone else. What about a person who, it's not just that they don't want to give up anything, but a part of what we seem to be addressing here is that even where there wouldn't be anything being given up, right, is el ochaser at all. So where there's no cost to the person, but he's simply unwilling to help another person. Yes, sir?
I think perhaps it's sort of like what we call like maybe a Purim evil versus a Hanukkah evil.
Okay.
Whereas,
compare them.
Whereas it's very obvious to everyone that if somebody is a thief, but, you know, is an outward Russia, okay, like, he's a bad dude, but fundamentally everybody understands that this Russia is so much more different than the rest of the world. Whereas somebody who fundamentally looks on the outside like a normal guy, he doesn't want to steal, he doesn't want to take from other people, but he's also selfish. You know, it's sort of like, you know, we the Greeks don't want to go out and destroy Judaism, we just want to make you like us. You know, we're very happy to let you in. It's like a rot at the core of society, which maybe is not, you know, on its face as dangerous, but is probably more dangerous than an actual Russia.
Well, I think getting into the Hanukkah Purim distinction gets a little confusing because it brings in so many other things, and we usually draw the distinction between the two on different lines. But just maybe to lay out, and I'll take the comments because it could get a little confusing. What I'm thinking of here is that there are a couple of different gradations that probably we should pay attention to. So, you know, you can have somebody who's not willing to give up anything to help anyone else. And here we're emphasizing also that there are situations we're talking about where it wouldn't involve giving up anything. So a person is not going to lose anything, but is indifferent to the suffering of someone else, is not moved to help someone else, even when there's no cost. So that clearly bothers us, right? And that's clearly something which should get major criticism.
You could say, like Elie Wiesel, the opposite of evil is not, the opposite of good is not evil, the opposite of good is indifference.
So that's the question. So is indifference the opposite? Is indifference the worst it can be? So in terms of passion, it's not the opposite. That's the thing. We know that hate and love are two sides of the same coin in terms of passion and in terms of energy, and that's why one could flip to the other so quickly. So in that sense, emotionally and psychologically, hate and love are not really as opposite as they seem, and indifference is much more distinct from either one. But in terms of evilness, and in terms of how afraid we are or how condemnatory we are of something, so is indifference the worst it can be? So it seems to me there are at least two distinct categories below it that we should be attention to. And this is where Russia, the English word, comes in. So what about somebody who is so indifferent to the suffering of others that he, and selfish, that he pursues his own goals regardless of the cost of others? So because he wants something, and the instinct to want something is understandable human instinct. Right? The question is just how much are you prioritizing that over everything else? So in our Mishnah, we seem, or certainly in our Gemara, when we understand Midas Dom as being specifically in cases where I'm not even losing out at all, right, which is actually not even so clear from the Mishnah, but it's more clear from the Gemaras, and more clear especially from our Gemara, where our Gemara really, in a sense, which we haven't seen yet, but our Gemara really, in a sense, kind of defines that most blatantly. So if we're talking about that kind of situation, somebody doesn't have to give up anything at all, and that's what we're talking about. So, okay, somebody's not moved to help anybody else and to give up anything for that. That's one thing. And that comes from a certain selfishness, to an extent, that they are so protective of their own interests that other people's needs did not convince them to give up anything of their own. But it comes with a certain degree of selfishness, and that outweighs other things. So apparently, we're not going to bother that guy right now. We're talking about a lower creature than that person. Right, because in our Gemara, which again we haven't yet talked about, we should probably make this discussion clear, but we're acknowledging that if there's some kind of trade-off at all, something you have to give up in order to benefit the other guy, okay, we'll talk about what that involves. But what about somebody who doesn't have to give up anything? There would be nothing you'd have to give up in order to help the other guy. So the fact that we're tolerating the first category means we allow a certain degree of selfishness. Right? So the fact that you don't want to give up something even minor, okay, fine. Your priority, looking out for number one first, we get that. We're only yelling at the person who wouldn't even have to give up anything. So there's a kind of person who is focused on his own needs, so much so that he is running over everybody else in the process and allowing and maybe causing the suffering of others. So where does that fit in on the evil spectrum? Right. So he's, on the one hand, we credit somebody with self-interest, right? In our case, we're saying self-interest is kind of understandable. So here, this person is motivated by self-interest. But he's also much worse because he's causing harm to others. You understand the issue? Right, just to say it again, until now, let's say we had two categories. You have one category, somebody who doesn't want to help somebody else, but it's because he would have to give up something to help other people. It's going to cost him to help. So we're not bothering him right now. He's not a Midas Dom guy. Right, we're only talking about people who are refusing to help but it wouldn't cost them anything. So apparently we're saying if you have your own goals, we get that. We're not going to hold it against you right now for worrying about your own interests. The only thing that's objectionable is not helping others, not worrying about other people when you don't have your own competing interest. So it's a point in your favor if you have your own competing interest. But what about somebody who is indeed worried about his own interest? So he should be better. And maybe it's a strong personal interest. But where he's worse is that he's not just failing to help someone. He's harming someone. In pursuing his own interest, he's causing suffering. So just to add to the categories, right? So that should be significantly more problematic. Even though we can subtract whatever credit we give to understanding that somebody has a right to pursue his own interests. But if he is imposing, inflicting so much harm on somebody else, that should make him worse. So how does that fit in? That's a question to think about. And then there is a creature that is lower than that. And that's something we haven't seen discussed at all. What about somebody who is actually interested in the cruelty? And somebody who's actually motivated by the harming of someone else. Where does he fit in the spectrum? Would he really be on the same plane as what we've been discussing so far? So, without trying to be machria the geopolitical issue, but just it is important, moral distinctions still are important, even without minimizing any of the horror of what's going on. So, Putin right now is inflicting horrific, horrific suffering on the people of Ukraine. But, now again, obviously not to come close in any way, this should not be understood as any kind of a justification, just as far as comparing it to Nazism or other such things. If he's doing it because he thinks he is advancing his own goal of expanding his territory, so is that the same thing as those who inflict cruelty for the sake of the cruelty? Those who were killing and butchering for the sake of the butchering. Now, I assume nobody's going to quote me out of context, and nobody's going to see this as any kind of the justification of the butchering for the advancing of the goal.
I'm already writing the foreword article.
Yes, but you understand the distinction, or are we saying there's no distinction? So I say, is that really the same as what the Nazis did? Should that really be said in the same breath? Or is there a gradation there? And that, again, not to dream of, in any sense, justifying what Putin's doing, but is that, are those comparable? Should this really be put on the same plane? Okay, so maybe Shmuel and Zach Danyasi?
Just linguistically, it seems like for the Midas Sodom category in the Mishnah, like that's talking about behavior an attribute where Rasha seems to be like the category of a person. Like it would seem that Rasha would be worse.
Right. So a part of what we see actually is that the Mefarshim aren't sure about this. And that's where Rabbeinu Yonah comes in, for example. And this plugs back into our Tzedakah Sugya, so it's an amazing sugya, an amazing parak, amazing everything. So yeah, this all comes back. You see, that's what Rabbeinu Yonah is dealing with, because Rabbeinu Yonah assumes that the Mishnah is talking about Tzedakah. And we just got off talking for a long time about the Chiyuvim of Tzedakah. So, what, all of a sudden this is optional now, or this is something which we could have a category where there are people who don't give any tzedakah and they're called Beinonim? Is that really conceivable? So in addressing that question, what does Rabbeinu Yonah say? And he says something pretty extraordinary in terms of its strictness, basically, in terms of the demands it puts on people. What he says is pretty extraordinary. It ties in a lot retroactively to our previous sugya. But what does Rabbeinu Yonah basically say on that Mishnah? If you saw it, and he said that this is not about what you do, right, to go to Shmuel's point, it's about your midah, literally. That the Mishnah is addressing pshuto kumashmo, the midah. That you have all the categories of people who give tzedakah, but the question is, who are they when they give it? Extraordinary kind of thing. And it's also extraordinary how this ties into our most recent discussion, the last part of the stucco that we talked about, right? The idea that you could give an ani money and yet you may lose the whole credit for it if you do it in a nasty way, you do it in an embarrassing way, that the mida could be completely defining of the experience. So here it's here Rabbi Yonah is addressing something which may not even express itself outwardly at all. But to say the person could be giving staka and midas don't, because his mentality is, I'm doing this begrudgingly. Shali, shali, v'shalcha, shalcha. Pretty extraordinary idea. So I think we got lost track already. Sorry. Yes, Shmuel, then Saki, then.
Maybe this is a little bit more of like a skills cover question, but I don't understand how to read the Mishnah as the Rosh is giving tzedakah.
Okay, so that is a fair question. So that maybe we should come back to it, but it is an important question, but let's come back to it. God willing, by the way, hopefully we'll have skills tomorrow, so we'll also maybe... Not that it's that...
Sorry?
What are
you saying? The Rosh was giving...
Saying that last category for Ben Yonah is saying that we are talking... we will come back to the details of how Ben Yonah interprets the whole Mishnah.
Or Ben Yonah saying that you don't want a potch from a Kaddish Baruch Hu for not giving stuff, so that's why you give it.
But you're just you're just motivated by pure Yira. But, so, yeah, sorry.
I mean, I could be wrong in maybe my understanding of Tosfos and his position on what Rava's position is, but my understanding of Tosfos is Rava's position is 100% about the guy who is ruthlessly self-interested. That you know, you have the guy who he wants to have, you know, sort of equal split of the land so much that'll cause people to get into these ridiculous situations where you have to split it this way and that, you know, obviously depending on if you hold by Rashi or you hold by Tosfos.
Okay, so getting into the Rashi-Tosfos part is important, so that we will come to that. So that's what I'm saying, like, you see how the details of the sugya and the details of this Mishnah are going to be so intertwined.
Like, for me, I'm like a little bit taken aback that we possibly like, where you're
saying. Okay, so hold on to that. So we're not going to get to that today, but hold on to that. Because you see, so it's like we can't separate out the Mishnah and the details of the sugya. They're all going to come back and forth. So... That's clearly important. So Rabbi Yonah's focus on the midos as so definitive of who you are, the internal midos is highly significant, and that's something to think about, and that's its own interpretation. Now, the Tashbetz in the Magen Avos, so he addresses, and he's responding to Rabbi Yonah, and he's assuming that we're talking about Gemilas Chesedim, which is also a chiyuv, but maybe has different kinds of parameters. So it doesn't necessarily strike us the same way. But one of the fundamental issues here that we need to try to figure out is, like, what could the Mishnah really be entertaining in light of what we have seen? So how is it possible to even have this other opinion, if it is another opinion? So to say, shali, shali, v'shalcha, shalcha, that is mida beinonis. So how is that ever possible? And that's part of what drove Rabbi Yonah, drove other perushim here. So is it possible after everything you've learned about being a good Jew that this could be a mida beinonis? So what's going on there? Yeah.
I guess it's more of a passive approach, I guess, to life almost. That it's like, I worry about myself, you worry about yourself, and, you know, we'll be fine. Versus, I guess, the rush of the last part is you're, like, actively going out of your way almost to, I guess, ruin other people or to gain from other people, but you give nothing of yourself. So I guess the Midas Beinonis is more just... very passive, like, I'm good, so I don't have to worry about you, and you're good, and if you have problems or your problems, I don't have to worry about it. Whereas the Rosh is, I guess, more like actively causing problems to other people and going out of his way to almost, you know, enhance the problem.
Okay, so that's a good question in terms of distinguishing between the Smida and the Mida, so the Mida of the Rosh. But just, I guess, the question is by itself, is it possible, just in light of what we know about the values of Tzedakah and Chesed, that could really be a mida beinonis, to say, even as you described it, that with, okay, I do me, you do you. That's all that matters.
And you're not a thief.
So that was the machlokas a little bit.
Right, between, so can you say... Right.
But what about, say, chesed and other types of...
Right. So then I guess the real question is, so what is the difference between that first line and the line of the Rasha, then? Meaning, it seems that a lot of it, like the midas beinonis, that we then say is midas adom, all sounds like it's part of being a Rasha, or having those not so good characteristics all make up a, I guess, Rasha-like personality.
Right, so then how could it be called beinonis? That's the question. How would anyone, how could it be an opinion that now a part of what he's saying is that what Tash Betz is saying, is that it's possible we're not even talking about two separate opinions, we're talking about different circumstances. And one of the things we'll see eventually, after we finish this, I mentioned yesterday, Rav Lichtenstein's article about this, which is available in Hebrew, and it's very long and detailed, so I'll send it around, but I'll probably send it around after we've seen the whole sugya. It'll be valuable for Chazara, but to try to work through it before you've seen everything else probably won't be as helpful. But one of the suggestions that he makes over there in the beginning, just talking about this, because again, it's very difficult to imagine that we can entertain this idea that somebody who's completely separate from Chesed could be considered Amida Beinonis. It seems to be very far from the attitude. Imagine the Torah uses language lo tuchal hisamein, the idea of hiding, and the hiding really means hiding other people. It's the image of the man sitting on the train with a newspaper when the pregnant lady comes on, and he holds the newspaper higher up so he can't see her. So he's hiding himself. He's hiding other people from him. So the notion that you can hide yourself from other people's suffering and somehow be considered average certainly seems very difficult. So we have to imagine that there are gradations here, and just the gradations, on the surface, just trying to get through the words, that you have to imagine that there are gradations just in terms of how much it's in your face. So Lichtenstein, this article talks about, like, are we talking about somebody who moves apartments? So before the new guy comes into the apartment, instead of just giving him the keys, he throws the keys into the river. So the guy shouldn't be then. So he doesn't need the keys anymore, but doesn't want the next guy to have the keys. Is that what we're talking about? That's that could conceivably be a mida beinonis. That makes sense. So it's hard to believe that that's what we mean. The person just is going out of his way to make sure that nobody benefits at all from what he has, even when there's no cost to him, and just letting other people suffer so that they shouldn't benefit at all, and that we could conceivably call that a Amida Beinonis. It seems very strange. And presumably there is no such opinion, or there's no... we have to figure out exactly how we draw the line. It may be very subjective, or may initially, on first blush, be subjective, but the degree of in-your-faceness of... how much do you have to be confronted by the need, and how easily it is. Now, this is a big philosophical question in general, and the question of the role of empathy, which many philosophers assume is a crucial trait in terms of getting people to do good things. And there are those who argue, there's even a recent book with the title Against Empathy, that it's actually possibly a harmful trait or a confounding trait, because why does it make sense that we should be so guided by that when it's not necessarily, this is worth mentioning after we spoke all this time about Kedimus and Stucka and the like, so it's not necessarily going to direct you on the proper path as far as your priorities. Maybe you'll empathize with those who are less deserving. Maybe in a fight you'll actually empathize with the wrong side, just because you feel some type of a kesher, but also even in less blatant things, you may prioritize the cause that is less deserving because of a greater sense of empathy, and overall, you may make decisions that are not appropriate because you are led astray, perhaps. So there's a big back and forth. There's a lot to say about it. But the whole idea that, and I think there's an answer to the question, but just calling the question to your attention, that here Rabbeinu Yonah is saying that if a person gives tzedakah and is not connecting to the emotional part of it, is not connecting to the rachmanis, so that's something very, very problematic, and we'll even call him terrible things on this mission, even if he actually is giving tzedakah. But there are some who argue, like, you know, in a sense, the author of that book I just mentioned, that he's not writing from a perspective of a religious Jew, but maybe you could almost argue that it's better not to come with empathy. A person about tzedakah should sit there with his yoredeya and his hilchos tzedakah, and he should do exactly what it says, and don't let himself get led astray by any of his emotions, because maybe he'll end up not making the right decisions as far as hilchos tzedakah are concerned. So maybe it's a negative. So here, what are we talking about? We're saying that there's a beinoni because he's just not moved to give, and how we're going to draw the lines, that's something that we're going to need to figure out a little bit. Shmuel?
Just, obviously, it's wrong to have, like, that attempt, but I feel like for mitzvah, that's like, the result should matter. Not more to the point where the intent doesn't matter, but just it should be highlighted a lot more.
So that, have we ever talked about that? That's actually...
That's the Rambam Bach.
Right. Well, a little bit, but it's interesting. Okay, so... All right. I know we're a little bit over time. We start a little bit late, so we'll go a little bit more over time, and then we'll just wrap them up to get into this tomorrow. It's fascinating stuff. So I'll just address that for a second, because you're bringing up a huge philosophical point, and we're going to borrow from next week, because it also relates to the end of this parak. So let's... credited against next week's time. So the point, we discussed this a couple of times, but it's interesting because it actually should be addressed from the other side too. So you just said that the results should matter more. So we've actually said that a number of times, right? We said that that was Chaim Shmuel Levitz's point from Penina, from that Gemara in the end of the parak. And we basically said that L'chumrah. Right, that it means that you can't rely on your efforts, and we can't say onus rachmana patre, that there has to be an actual result taking place, because suffering human beings are not able to say, I know you're trying, and that's all that matters. God can say that, he can read your mind, he knows what's going on, but a suffering human being can't do that. So, when it comes to ben odom l'chaveros, so there is a extra need to make sure you actually get the right results, and that might be the lesson of the end of this parak that we're in here. And many achronim do work off that principle as far as pirsum minisa and mitzvos b'adam l'chavero, having that yisod. That's what we've mentioned. But what's also striking is that there are some who have suggested it's true l'kula as well. And they say this to address an Or HaChaim. There's an Or HaChaim in the end of Sefer Bereishis, the very end of Sefer Bereishis, the end of Aichi. So Yosef says to his brothers who are trying to make up with him, and the whole question of what exactly happened there is its own discussion, but Yosef says to his brothers, Atem chashavtem alai ra, that you wanted to hurt me, v'alukim chashav alai tov, something like that, right? God worked it out that it's going to be good for me. So what's the message there? You tried to hurt me, but in the end, God had different plans. So the Or HaChaim has a comment there that, yeah, it's like, you know, those scenes in the movies where somebody tries to poison somebody else, and the cup gets switched around, and then it keeps getting switched around so the person doesn't actually get the poison. So, yeah, so that's what happened. You tried to poison the other guy, and in the end, you get the poison, so all's well that ends well. So the Achronim ask, really? You know, all's well that ends well? Attempted murder isn't a thing. That's not a problem. the fact that you tried to kill the other guy, so it doesn't matter that he didn't die. I mean, it didn't matter you tried to kill him because he didn't die. So
almost only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades.
Right. So what's is that true? So almost doesn't count. So some of the achronim say, there are some achronim who write that, yeah, that's the same yisod. It's the flip side of the same yisod, that it's a ben ol machavero, right, trying to hurt somebody else, ben ol machavero. So we only care about the results. So as long as the results worked out okay, so that's the point. So I think it's a very difficult conclusion to come to. Because we actually see that when it comes to mitzvahs, Berad Machaveiro actually wrote about this in the introduction to my first book many years ago, that you have to actually be machmir from both sides. That you have to be machmir on the results, that's the point of Pnina. And because of the midos connection, you also have to be machmir on the, so to speak, mind-body connection. So it ends up not that you can be makel because of this results focus, but it's an extra chumrah. So what the Aruch Chaim means, I think this is what we could talk about a different time. But to say that, and it probably relates specifically to what Yosef was trying to tell them, it's a whole different story. But to say that there is no importance to what your intentions are, to what your internal midos are, as long as you get the good results, it's a very striking idea. Yeah.
Just like, midos benonis doesn't mean it doesn't matter, like it's a good thing. Okay, meaning it's just...
Yeah, understood.
Yeah.
Right, but the idea... But I'm saying what you're saying is something that is discussed. I think it's just a very difficult idea to assume that l'kula we can rely on. I think l'chumra, the idea of the importance of the results of Berad Machaveiro, is clearly there, and that's one of the points that emerges. But there is this notion of it being invoked l'kula also, and... We've seen that a little bit in Hilchos Taka, in that discussion, on the question of whether one can be a considered a tzaddik because he inadvertently ended up helping people even without any intention. But would that really fully address all of our goals? Remains yet to be seen. So can I be excused for keeping you overtime because I mean well? So that's a bit of a machavero, so it's a good question. All right, so a lot more to say about this very fascinating sugya. We have to actually maybe even get into the Gemara and some of the dinim that relate to this or whatever we thought. So that's on our agenda also. Baruch Hashem, we will get to that tomorrow.